The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Good day, everyone, and welcome again to another edition of Boomer Generation Radio. This is your host, Richard Address, coming to you live from the studios of WWDB AM 860 here in the Delaware Valley and streaming live on WWDBAM.com. We want to welcome you again. We have a jam-packed show for you today. Two very, very interesting and exciting guests. Just a few announcements before we begin. Number one, again, a reminder that if you want to chime in and give your suggestions for future shows or comments on what we're doing, the email address is boomergenerationradio@gmail.com. That's boomergenerationradio@gmail.com. And before we get to our first guest, Randy Redmond Oster from Massachusetts, who I hope is on the line. Randy, are you there? Hello, Randy. Randy has, I guess it was some interference between Massachusetts and here. But anyway, before we're going to try to reconnect with Randy, I want to make you aware of today's a trivia question for a great prize, It's April 1st. And as you know, the baseball season has started on a successful note here. If it ended tomorrow, the Phils are in the playoffs. So here's today's trivia question. And the number to call in is 610-664-4100. On June 4th, 2013, not so long ago, June 4th, 2013, the Phillies outfielder John Mayberry Jr. became only the sixth player in Major League history to do what in a game? And if you could really do this well, the B part is, and what differentiated him from the other five? But we'll just take the first part of that question, if you can come up with this. On June 4th, 2013, Phil's outfielder John Mayberry Jr. became only the sixth player in Major League history to do what in a game? And today's prize I am holding are two tickets to next Monday's opening home opener for the Fightin' Phils against those Milwaukee Brewers. So if you want to win two tickets to next Monday, the 7th of April's home opener, on June 4th, 2013, Phils outfielder John Mayberry Jr. became only the sixth player in Major League history to do what in a game? And for a good feeling, what differentiated him from the other five? But just give me that first part. And the number to call in is 610-664-4100. Nobody gets the tickets. Tony can get the tickets. Randy, are you there? Hello?
Hello?
Randy. Ah, there you are. Technology worked again.
Yeah.
Very, very good. Welcome to the show. Welcome, Randy Redmond Oster from Fairfield, Connecticut.
Yes.
Author of Questioning Protocol, a very, very interesting book, the subtitle of which is How One Mom Dispensed Equal Doses of Humor, Humility, and Corporate Smarts to Help Her Family Navigate Their Healthcare Crisis. Welcome, Randy. Welcome to Boomer Generation Radio. One of the reasons why we wanted to have this conversation with you is because so many of our generation, of baby boom generations, are caring for people. The usual thought is that, well, they're caring for an older parent, but in reality, as you point out, there are 141 million Americans with chronic diseases, and 36 million a year will face hospitalization. That's like a third of the American population.
Yes.
Wow. So you wrote this book, Questioning Protocol. Why?
So I, like many boomers, care for my parents and also have children and also work full time. And what happens when you have a plate full is you really need to be efficient. And when you have a husband who has a pre-existing condition, when you have a child that has a pre-existing condition, and my son has Crohn's disease, and your 85-year-old mother lives with you, you get to know the emergency room. And when you're as busy as a person is when you're working full time, you really want to have trust in the healthcare system. And what I discovered as I was in and out of the hospital with all three of them was the same way that we were designing aircraft engine parts, because that's what I did in my career, would not work in the healthcare industry. The processes were so different, and that what I saw was room for improvement. So why did I write the book? Because I knew that the strategies I was using to help my loved ones thrive could help other people as well. And that's how my son is doing fabulous. He's on no medications with his Crohn's. How my father had a beautiful end of life, and how my mother is also enjoying her old age. And so I like to share the tips, the tools, and the techniques from my corporate experience and my compassion to help others.
So navigating the healthcare system in the United States of America is can be a full-time job, can it?
It can. And the hard part is when you're dealing with someone that you love that's not is ill, you're not on your game. That's a very hard emotional time. And the fact that we have to be even smarter and even more motivated and even more knowledgeable at a time that we really just want to hug is a challenge for us. But there are techniques and there are things we can do that can really empower ourselves to become our best healthcare advocate.
We're talking with Randy Redmond Oster here on Boomer Generation Radio and about her book, Questioning Protocol, dealing with really how to help navigate the healthcare system when you're dealing with someone dealing with chronic illness, especially a loved one. And Randy, you came from a business background, correct?
Yes, I was with GE for almost 20 years. And so, I started in engineering with on aircraft engines and then continued on into the finance world.
So you're faced with an issue with your parents and your son navigating the healthcare system, trying to work, trying to juggle a family, trying to juggle all the emotional stresses and strains, probably dealing with a little, as they call, caregiver fatigue. How did you arrive? What was one of the first mental adjustments that you had to make from trying to and dealing with this this maze?
So there were a couple of things that I did, and one of them I'm going to say is being grateful. And that sounds very ironic, because when you're dealing with an end of life issue, someone with a chronic disease, how in the world can you feel grateful when your whole world feels like it's crashing down on you? And what I realized was I needed to find the strength to be there for everyone else, plus my manager and my boss and all those demands. And what I found was the first thing I did was I allowed myself to slow down. I allowed myself to feel, to see, and then to accept that I couldn't change what my reality was. And what I did was I accepted the fact that I was going to work on whatever the issue was for that day. And when I would deal with the problem for the day without worrying about the future, I had confidence that the future would take care of itself. And that helped me feel like I was at least making some progress, because when you have someone who's ill, the world slows down. Recuperation, they're not, you know, my son wasn't even walking. So it's really hard to not get frustrated because you have so much going on. And what I did is I found the small things to just be grateful for. And that helped me get through the minutes, the hours, and then the process so that I can now be on the other side and hopefully help others.
I have to ask you, that's a wonderful sentence, to feel, to see, and to accept, and to do this on a day-by-day basis. How difficult was it to make that transition from the business world and deadlines and programs and juggling to this sort of like really pulling back and to see, to feel, and to accept? How difficult of a transition was that?
It was so huge that in my book, Questioning Protocol, which I wrote in the hospital, I had nothing to do but to start to worry. It was a prescription for depression.
Wow.
And I sat there and I said, how is a person who's so busy, who doesn't even know, you know, how she's going to get through the day because she had so many deadlines. Now we just sit in the hospital. My child, if he's not screaming in pain, it was because he was after an operation and I'm giving him ice chips and he's just sleeping there, okay? What am I supposed to do? And what I ended up doing, because I didn't sit very well, is I started writing the book in the hospital without knowing the outcome.
Wow.
Because I was seeing so many examples of where we could come up with process improvements. And so the book is actually in the present tense. And I just figured I could use my skills to help others. But that's an example of, you know, saying, why was I given this challenge?
Mm-hmm.
And then how am I supposed to use it in a positive way? And that was my method.
So you're sitting in the hospital with your son, mm-hmm. writing this book.
Yes.
The scene is, I have to ask you, as you were doing this over, and this was obviously a fairly long process, correct?
Yes.
What did you, did nurses or physicians come by and, you know, what are you doing and offer their support or offer their suggestions, or did you do this in splendid isolation?
Oh, I did it right in front of their faces. I had every day I would start work at like 8:30 after I ate my breakfast, and I would type what was going on, and I would tell them. What was interesting was they became very aware that whatever was happening, the good, the bad, was going to be documented. And naturally, and as anyone who's been through any healthcare issues, there were many wonderful examples of wonderful care and wonderful caring nurses and doctors. And then there are examples that you could do things a little bit better. They're both in the book. And there was one funny story where my doctor he was away at a conference. And the only time he could speak to me was from a plane that was leaving, taking off.
Right.
Okay, and I'm in a car on a cell phone, and we have to make a huge medical decision. Should my son take steroids or not take steroids? And he gets on the phone with me, and I hear the standard stewardess saying, and when the pressure is decompressive.
Oh, yeah, right.
Okay. She's going through this whole thing, and I can't even hear him. And you know what I said to him? I said, this isn't enough time for us to have this conversation. My son is off the medication. And when I saw him a couple of days later, he said, that conversation's in the book, isn't it? I said, uh-huh. And I said to him, I said, you know, because he felt bad. And I said, look, the story's not over yet. You have time to redeem yourself. And he does. I mean, we developed a wonderful relationship, and he really helped my son come up with a great way for handling his Crohn's that's unique and very powerful. But they knew I was writing the book, and this last checkup my son had, I walked in, and now that the book's coming out, he says to me, you know, they're a little nervous about the book. And there's nothing to be nervous about. My son's doing great. But there are processes that can be improved. And my strategy is really to empower patients and loved ones so that the same way my son got the best care, everyone else doesn't have to write a book so that the medical community's scared. They can just start to use the same tips and tools.
We're speaking with Randy Redman-Oster, the author of Questioning Protocol here on Boomer Generation Radio on WWDB AM 860 here in the greater Philadelphia area, streaming live on WWDBAM.com, and we'll be back with Randy in a minute. But I do want to remind you of a very good friend of the show's here, the Hecht Investment Group, of Johnny Montgomery Scott, which provides concierge financial consulting and planning services. Using a formal investment process as their foundations, clients receive frequent communication and rapid response to questions, and there are no needs greater than your own when it comes to personal financial planning. The Hecht Investment Group provides experienced guidance and an efficient management process that is important in today's environment. We urge you to contact the Hecht Investment Group toll-free at 855-289-2168. That's 855-289-2168. Your visit hectinvestmentgroup.com. The Hecht Investment Group is also on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. And Peter Hecht was recognized by the Philadelphia Magazine and New Jersey Magazine as a five-star wealth manager for 2013 and 2014. Janie Montgomery Scott is a member of the NYSE, the New York Stock Exchange, FINRA, and SIPC. That's the Hecht Investment Group of Janie Montgomery Scott. Give them a call toll-free again at 855-289-2168. Tell them you heard about it on Boomer Generation Radio. And again, they visit them on hectinvestmentgroup.com, on Twitter, on LinkedIn, and on Facebook. That's 855-289-2168. Again, we're with Randy Redman-Oster, the author of Questioning Protocol. Randy, if somebody wants to tap into the book, how do they, is this a regular bookstore? Is it online? It's, both?
Yeah, the easiest way is you just go to Amazon.com, Questioning Protocol, and it's in pre-release right now, and they can order it. And what they'll get is the story, but also what they can do, so that it's easy tips and tools so that they can feel, instead of overwhelmed, they can feel control.
And the book is Questioning Protocol, and Randy's last name, if you want to put it in on the little thingy on there on Amazon, is O-S-T-E-R, and it's Questioning Protocol. What do people need to understand, Randy, about dealing with when they find themselves in the middle of a health crisis? What are some of the things that, based upon your research, your experience, they need to know?
So the first thing that I would say is that people want to do the right thing. But the system is really set up so that they have limited time. They have a lot of decisions to make. And so what our job is it's our job to take the long view approach and understand that we have to advocate for ourselves and for our loved ones, and that being passive might not necessarily deliver the right approach for yourself. It could, but the first step that people need to do is they need to ask the hard questions, which is different than saying, "Doctor, if it was your mom or your son, what would you do?" Okay, that's a very different approach. And the hard questions sometimes can give us some answers we don't really want, but can help us understand what is the right choice for ourselves and our loved ones.
So give me an example of a hard question, because I think in my experience as a clergy, a lot of people will turn around to the physician and say, well, if it was your, you know, mom, dad, sister, brother, whatever, what would you do? So you're saying that's perhaps not the right one. Give me an example of a hard question.
So my father had a brain tumor. He was from the Greatest Generation. He lived a wonderful life. He's 79 years old, and he's in the hospital. And it was a glioblastoma, which is not a brain tumor that is round and you can just cut out. It's more like tree roots growing through your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're first learning all of this instantly. Whoever heard of these things? And the hard question in this case was, the doctor had arranged for surgery the next day. He literally was in the emergency room, and then the next day he was going to have brain surgery. The hard question is, doctor, how long will he live if he has surgery? And doctor, how long will he live if he doesn't? And when I got the answer to that question, that changed the course that my father chose. In this case, the hard question gave the answer of, if he had surgery, he would live another 8 months. He would need radiation. He would have chemotherapy. The very next day, he might not speak so well. He might have some paralysis. And if he didn't have surgery, he would live 8 weeks. He would slowly not be able to walk, but he would probably, they said, eventually just go to sleep. And in this case, my father chose not to have the surgery. But what that did is it gave us 8 beautiful weeks where I got to speak to him, where I got to be there with him, where his friends got to come and look over old albums. And so it was the right decision. But if it wasn't for that question, he was going to have that surgery the next day.
Do you outline these hard questions in the book?
The answers are yes. As you read the book, you'll start to know what the hard questions are. And what I do in the book, at the end of each chapter, I literally say what you can do now. So I explain what I did, and then I go, okay, here's what you can do when you get faced with this, so that people will go, oh, I went through this, or this is how she handled it. And then I give that tip, tool, or the technique that I use very clearly so others can learn.
You think it's possible that people are afraid to ask the hard questions, as you say it, because they're themselves afraid of the hard answer?
Yes. I think it is hard to ask the hard questions. And I will share with you, the doctors will only answer the questions you ask. So it's important that we have to think through what are our values and what are our needs, and we need to look at that longer range picture to make sure we're getting the answers that work for us. This is a very difficult time, and what I also say in the book is sometimes your choice is between bad and worse.
Right.
Okay? What I learned was I had to know that at least I did my best, that by facing the hard questions, I at least, the outcome might not have been what we wanted, but we tried our best. And that helped also feeling grateful that, so I had some peace.
You know, we come back to this concept of gratefulness. I'd like you to explore that a little bit. I think to some people listening who may be walking this walk right now, it may be hard to feel grateful. They may, in a cynical way or because of a variety of real reasons, turn around to you and say, Randy, what am I grateful for? Look what's happening here. This is horrible. This is sad. This is debilitating. It's destroying everything. How can I feel grateful to be in this position?
So I have, in the book, I actually describe at one point, my son was in the ambulance, screaming in pain. We're driving an hour and a half to the next place. At that point, I was so upset. And I actually, as the ambulance was driving on I-95, and I felt that he was going too fast, in a pouring rainstorm, there was a truck, an 18-wheeler, that was driving too fast next to the ambulance. And I actually looked up and I said, you know what, if you're going to crash right now, and if this is the end of our life, it's okay. That's how low I had gotten. Okay, that's how overwhelmed I felt, that if it was the end, it was going to be okay. And that's what I was thinking. Don't make my son go through this anymore. I can't take it anymore. And I closed my eyes, and I was waiting for the crash. That was it. And the ambulance driver, who was playing hard metal music, I couldn't even stand the music he was playing, he turned to me and he said, do you like this music? And I was in such a thought of the crash was going to happen that I didn't hear him. And he said, do you like this music? And I said, no. I said, can you turn on something else? And when he turned on and switched the radio station, the song that came on was Mariah Carey, when she sings Hero.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point she sings, there's a strength inside you. You will find another way. And at that point, when I heard that song, I was grateful for this song coming on and giving me a little bit of strength. When I turned around to see my son and how he was doing, and then I turned around and I noticed that 18-wheeler truck was now exiting, and I realized there was going to be no crash. The rain also stopped. That pounding rain stopped. And you know what? I looked up and I was grateful that the rain stopped, and I even fell asleep for the rest of the ride. And so now, here I am in the middle of an ambulance, right, with my kid getting ready for an emergency surgery, and there I am, happy that I'm hearing a song that's calming me down and that the rain stopped. It's hard sometimes to find those moments, but that's what I found, that when I took the time to see differently and hear differently and let myself feel differently, I found little things that in the past I wouldn't have noticed that gave me strength.
So these, would it be safe to say in your experience that these types of healthcare crises, as crazy, as fraught with danger and fear as they are, can also be moments that open the door to profound spiritual truth?
I found that. I found that I had a change in who I was, how I went about my life, what my mission is. Look at how my whole mission has changed, to help educate other people so that they can thrive through the system. And when I say thrive, because I'm not saying that, you know, sometimes the outcomes aren't what you want it to be, but how do you navigate a system that sometimes doesn't feel very compassionate, right? Because people are rushing. And I said, we have to help. As you said earlier, there are 141 million people in the United States with a chronic disease. Okay, so people with chronic diseases end up in the hospital a lot. 36 million people are running into the healthcare world. And you know what? That's a scary time. And so for me, what I found was that by finding a way to just accept and then allow some wisdom to come in, it helped me help my son, my husband, my mother, and then also cope so that this didn't become the prescription for depression that it could have been.
We've been speaking with Randy Redman Oster, the author of Questioning Protocol. We're just about out of time for this segment, Randy. I really want to thank you again. You can get the book, Questioning Protocol, by going on Amazon.com. And I want to thank you very, very much for just giving us this little tip to feel, to see, and to accept in one's gratitude as you navigate the healthcare system. Randy, thank you very much for being a guest here on Boomer Generation Radio. Have a great day, and continued good luck with your work and your speaking with the book. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we move on to our next segment, there's a couple of things we want to take care of, a couple of announcements from a couple of friends of ours. Number one, from the Samaritan Healthcare system, they really asked me to remind you that if you're worried about your parents, perhaps your parents' failing memory, you're concerned about your parents' safety at home and not sure where to turn for help, if you're concerned about any of these, we suggest that you contact SeniorWise, which is here for you. SeniorWise geriatric care managers can provide a comprehensive assessment and care plan, help keep your loved ones safe at home, screen and monitor in-home services, and help you avoid costly mistakes. It can also help ease your loved one's transition to a care facility if that becomes necessary. SeniorWise is a member of the Samaritan Family of Services, and to speak with a SeniorWise geriatric care manager today, you can call them at 856-552-5166. That's 856-552-5166. Mention that you heard about them on Boomer Generation Radio, and we just spoke with Randy, and we understand, and again, from her perspective, how important advocacy is. Again, the Geriatric Care Manager Program at SeniorWise is 856-552-5166. Or you can log on to www.seniorwisecare.org. That's www.seniorwisecare.org. The number again is 856-552-5166. I want to also mention again another one of our good friends here on Boomer Generation Radio, 50andbeyond.com, which is a content-based website for the baby boomer and senior populations. This comprehensive website covers a wide range of topics, including health and wellness, financial and legal, senior services, leisure and lifestyle, as well as real estate and design services. And you'll be able to find fascinating stories as well on local and national issues. 50andbeyond.com is committed to connecting you with the most highly qualified and respected professionals in the greater Philadelphia and South Jersey region. Once you are on 50andbeyond.com, be sure to sign up for their informative newsletter. And you can also check out their community calendar for special events in the greater Philadelphia and South Jersey area. 50andbeyond.com also offers a free Ask the Expert page where you can ask your own personal questions on an array of topics and getting your answers from the experts themselves. And listen, if you hate sitting and reading off a computer screen, and I know some of you may do that, don't worry about it. 50andbeyond.com has you covered. Paired with the website, 50andbeyond.com also produces a free bi-monthly printed magazine. It's distributed to over 200 area locations, and the magazine is a perfect one for active adults who are on the go. You can find it at your local supermarket, library, doctor's offices, and many other local businesses. And if you can't find a copy, you can download it directly from 50andbeyond.com or get a copy sent straight to you by emailing info, that's I-N-F-O, at 50andbeyond.com. 50andbeyond.com simplifies the lives of baby boomers and seniors, so log on today and find that information that matters to you. That's 50andbeyond.com. We're about to welcome our second guest in a couple of seconds, but I just want to remind you this special quiz, our trivia question today, for two tickets to next Monday's opening game of the first place playoff-bound Philadelphia Phillies, it should only be. On June 4th, 2013, Phillies outfielder John Mayberry Jr. became only the sixth player in Major League history to do what in a game? Only the sixth player in Major League history to do what in a game? John Mayberry Jr., it's easy for you to say. June 4th, 2013, Phillies outfielder John Mayberry Jr. became only the sixth player in Major League history to do what? The number to call in for those two tickets, 610-664-4100. Time's running out, 610-664-4100. And the next portion of Boomer Generation Radio is brought to you by Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services located in eight states in the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, and near Midwest regions of the United States. Kendall advocates for and empowers older adults to reach their full potential and is committed to working with others to together transform the experience of aging. And to learn more about Kendall, which is K-E-N-D-A-L, visit kendall.org or call toll-free 888-759-0128. That's 888-759-0128. And hopefully on the remote interview line is Paul Greenwood calling in from San Diego. Mr. Greenwood, are you there?
I sure am, Richard. Good morning.
Hey, welcome. Welcome. Thank you for getting up so early. And how's things in San Diego today? Beautiful as usual?
Well, actually, we're very thankful. We have a little bit of rain, much needed, not enough, but we'll take whatever we can. So a little bit of drizzle and showers this morning.
We have some leftover snow here, if you'd like it. It's still in the parking lot here.
Well, actually, we need some more snow in the Sierra Nevada, so I'll take that, too.
Okay. The issue that really, and I thank you, Paul, for calling in to Boomer Generation Radio. The issue is a very serious one, and you've been involved in your professional life as a prosecutor, if I'm not mistaken, assistant district attorney for San Diego County in California, dealing with the issues of elder abuse. This is a subject that is rarely discussed. It's one of those, I think, still taboo subjects. Mm-hmm. And the focus of our show here is on baby boomers and what's happening in their families. Talk to us a little bit about what you're seeing. How prevalent is this issue of elder abuse?
Well, it is far more prevalent than we truly understand. And I've been, for the last 18 years, Richard, prosecuting nothing but crimes committed against older adults. I am a product of the baby boomer generation myself. Both my parents, fortunately, are still alive. My mother's 90, my father's 91. My father, sadly, has advanced stages of Alzheimer's, living in a facility in England. But I have been shocked over the last 18 years at the extent of this problem. And 18 years ago, I had no knowledge that it even existed. We'd had specialized prosecutors for child abuse and spousal abuse, but it was a new innovation for us to think that there might be enough cases for a prosecutor like myself. And what we've discovered, unfortunately, Richard, is that it's an epidemic, and it's not just in San Diego, of course, it's throughout the globe, but primarily, of course, we're focusing on the United States. And in every state, there is a significant amount of crimes committed. But the problem is that most of it goes undetected, goes uninvestigated, and therefore unprosecuted.
So you use the word epidemic. That's a rather strong word. What do you mean by an epidemic?
Well, but it is, because just the statistics alone of the demographics, as we both know, this is why you have a boomer generation program here designed to attract this audience. The over 85s is the fastest growing segment of our
right.
population. And as a result, there is a huge portion of that generation that is being victimized right now, and it's increasing. And if my caseload is anything to go by, then it is becoming an epidemic. But the problem and the challenge, Richard, is trying to get people around the country to wake up to this fact and to actually respond and be more aware and be more proactive.
So let's talk about, when you say elder abuse, what exactly are we talking about? Physical abuse? Are we just talking about physical abuse, or
no,
or emotional, financial?
All aspects. It covers, obviously, the classic punching, slapping, hitting, but it goes beyond that. And of course, whenever I meet people, if I'm traveling, they go, oh, and they ask me what I do, and I say elder abuse prosecution. Oh, you mean in nursing homes? I said, well, that's just one little sliver. It happens all over the community. So there's the classic punching, hitting, pushing. There's the elder neglect by specifically caregivers who do not provide the proper care and attention, who literally abandon their patients, don't feed them the right food, don't give them the right medication, etc. And then you've got the, as you say, the emotional or mental suffering that is being inflicted upon seniors. And then abandonment of seniors, dumping them literally on the steps of hospitals and just walking away. And then you've got the whole different area of financial exploitation of seniors, which covers a whole variety of different crimes.
Okay. So I guess I have to ask you the question. You've been doing this for 18 years. Why? I mean, this is obviously a silly question, but it's really not a silly question, I guess.
It's not. And it's very unusual for a prosecutor to specialize in one area for so long. And the reason is, Richard, because when I first was given this task, I honestly thought, oh, it doesn't sound too attractive an assignment. I'll do it. I'll do it willingly for 2 to 3 years, and then I'll move back into the real good stuff. And, of course, how wrong was I? Because in the first 5 years, I was prosecuting homicides, sons murdering their mothers. I was prosecuting serious sexual assault cases in facilities. I was prosecuting large sums of elder financial cases. And I realized, my goodness, this is an untapped area. And the frustration that I was hearing from adult protective service workers all across the country was, Greenwood, why aren't other prosecutors seeing what you're seeing? Why aren't other prosecutors doing what you're doing?
Well, again, why is this happening? What is it about that you're finding, or what is it in your experience in this society that is causing this epidemic of people abusing older adults?
Well, sadly, there's a cultural thing about ageism, Richard. Unfortunately, victims of crimes who are over a certain age don't appear to get the same kind of level of attention as younger victims. Because you always hear on the media when a child tragically is killed, but you don't always hear when an 85-year-old is murdered by their own child. You also have the problem when there isn't a homicide, but you get a financial exploitation, that very often the crime is not reported by the victim because of embarrassment or fear or some other reason, such as cognitive inability to recognize that they are a victim. And then you've got that other challenge, which is that law enforcement sometimes does not take these cases seriously enough. Or if there is an allegation of financial exploitation, the law enforcement can fall into the trap of thinking that it's a civil matter and will basically tell the family to go away and go find a lawyer. And very often these cases are not just, quote, civil. They do in fact lead to proper criminal charges if in fact the detective does the right job.
Is there training, developing training for law enforcement officers as well as prosecutors on this issue, or is it something that people have to learn by just doing it and experience?
No, there is training, and in fact, what is interesting, what's encouraging, is that there is more and more training now being offered. There's more and more grants being issued around the country for states and counties within states to train local law enforcement on how to recognize these activities of crimes, how to respond, how to investigate. And there are also trainings nationally for prosecutors like myself on how to convert these investigations into aggressive, effective prosecutions. One of the biggest issues that I faced early on, I would go around to law enforcement agencies in my county and say, why don't you bring me these cases? And the answer that I got everywhere I went, Richard, was, Greenwood, you don't want to touch these cases. And I would ask, well, why not? And they would say, because elderly people make poor witnesses in the courtroom. Well, nothing could be further from the truth, but that's the misconception that is out there, and it unfortunately pervades even into prosecutors' offices. A lot of prosecutors are fearful of putting on a 95-year-old victim because they are afraid that because of forgetfulness or whatever, it's going to make for a poor case. But invariably, these witnesses are very, very effective, and of course they have such jury appeal.
Mm-hmm. Are you finding an increase in financial abuse?
Yes. And as a result, I spend a lot of my time, Richard, actually going out into the community, trying to educate not only the boomer generation, because that is the audience that needs to be hearing this message. People like myself who have 90-year-old parents or 80-year-old parents, they need to understand that their parents are at tremendous risk of being taken advantage of. So it's education of that group, but it's also educating the professionals. Finally, about 5 years ago in California, after much advocacy by prosecutors and law enforcement and other folks, we got the California legislature to make every single bank teller in the state of California a mandated reporter of suspected financial exploitation of the elder. And so now we see an increase in the reporting coming in to law enforcement, because so often, as we know, the scams are rife. You know, the one of the most popular ones right now is the grandma scam, you know, where the crook calls up the unsuspecting grandma, pretending to be the grandson, telling his grandmother that he's in jail in British Columbia or in Mexico City. He's been down here for a friend's wedding, and he's in jail because he had too much to drink and he crashed the car, the rental car. So he gets grandma, unsuspectingly, to withdraw $5,000 from her bank or credit union, go over to Walmart and use MoneyGram to transfer the money, $5,000, to what they think is the grandson's lawyer. And it's happening every single day in the United States of America. So it's things like that where the bank tellers need to be aware. When an 85-year-old widow walks into the bank and says, can I withdraw $5,000 in cash, it should immediately send alarm bells ringing in that branch.
And so now the law of California is that the bank tellers are mandated reporters.
They have to report. If they suspect, reasonable suspicion is all they need. And the great thing is that so many financial institutions are worried about being sued by their customer for interfering, but that's not going to happen when you are a mandated reporter.
We're speaking with Paul Greenwood from the District Attorney's Office in San Diego County about this, as he says, epidemic of elder abuse, really taking apart not only physical but emotional and financial. And we're going to be back with Paul in a minute, but I just want to remind our audience that this portion of Boomer Generation Radio is brought to you by Kendall Outreach, serving the field of aging by raising public awareness and advocacy around the important issues of older adults. Through education, training, and implementation of comprehensive approaches to safe, individualized, long-term care practices, Kendall Outreach has been sharing Kendall's approach to quality care with consumers, advocates, providers, government agencies, and related organizations since 1989. To learn more, visit Kendall.org, that's K-E-N-D-A-L.org, and click on Outreach, Kendall Outreach, again, K-E-N-D-A-L.org, and click on Outreach. Paul, the I imagine you're also involved with this, from what we're hearing, growing trend of computer online scams. Do you get involved? I'm sure you do get involved with that.
Yes, unfortunately, many elders who have become more acquainted with computers in the last 10 years are getting these unsolicited emails, and I mean, we all get them, but most of us, unfortunately, don't respond to them. But a lot of elders are curious, particularly where I just had one the other day from one of my acquaintances in England. Well, of course, it wasn't. It was from the crook who had got into their account and given me the sad story that they were stranded in the Ukraine and they needed me to wire £1,500 over to them. I mean, seniors are getting the same kind of emails. They're getting offers of ridiculous investment opportunities which don't exist. And this is the problem, Richard. When they fall for this and when they do succumb to transferring what is large sums of money to these crooks, and when they discover that it's a scam, they don't tell anybody. And I've had so many victims that we've uncovered. And when I meet with them and I gently ask them, why didn't you say anything? Their immediate response was, Mr. Greenwood, the last person that I want to find out about this is my own children, because I'm afraid what they might do if they found out.
Do you go to like senior centers and assisted living facilities and CCRCs to do educational programs to alert older adult populations on this?
I do, and I've learned by mistake, never in winter, never at night. I can never compete with the Wheel of Fortune, because that's what the seniors will never get out of their chairs to go and hear me speak. It's always got to be at lunchtime with an attractive message, because people have, in well-meaning people, have put flyers in their local retirement facilities. Come and hear Deputy District Attorney Paul Greenwood talk about elder abuse.
Thanks a lot. Right.
But if we translate it into, come and hear Deputy District Attorney Paul Greenwood tell you how you can prevent yourself becoming a victim of identity theft, that's a positive message.
Right.
So people will come, and I always try to keep the message positive, because even though what you and I are talking about can, in one sense, be very discouraging, the tone has to be upbeat, it has to be positive, it has to be, we've got to take control, we've got to be savvy, and we've got to be on the lookout for our less fortunate colleagues who may already be victims of elder abuse.
Other than, I guess, what you've just talked about, this sense of embarrassment, a sense of fear,
correct,
what are some of the other challenges that in prosecuting these cases that you face?
Well, once we've got through that, and once we've got the information, it's amazing, really, how we can corroborate the evidence through so many different means. I think the initial hurdle is making sure that we get that information from the bank teller, from the neighbor, from the rabbi, from the pastor, from all kinds of people. So then I can work with the victim. And even though victims may come to court with a certain degree of memory impairment, it doesn't matter. Because jurors understand, particularly when I have a financial exploitation case, I can tell you, Richard, that when jurors see my victim and when they see the defendant and they understand the impairment issues that my victim is grappling with, my jurors don't tolerate that behavior by the defendant. They know exactly why it is the defendant took advantage of this particular victim. I mean, I'm fortunate. I have a tremendous support staff. I have paralegal. I have a victim advocate. I have investigators. So I have a lot of different people who can provide the background information that I need. For example, before they come to court, does my victim need a hearing aid? Do they need eyeglasses? Do they need additional oxygen? So these are all things that we have learned over the years to be prepared for so that the day in court can be minimally disruptive for the victim.
How difficult it is to prosecute these cases, how difficult it is to really get the people who are perpetrating these frauds, scams, etc.
The crooks out there who hide behind the internet, behind the telephone that they pick up at Walmart, and it's a track phone which you can very rarely track down, actually. Those are very difficult to find. You have to have some luck. You have to have some hardworking detectives who are willing to do search warrants. So those cases are indeed very frustrating. And I'm still tackling those. And I haven't been very successful in 18 years in catching those kind of crooks who often are overseas or out of the country, maybe in Canada or other places. But locally, it's a very much a different story. We are able to issue many, many cases. And in fact, Richard, I am blessed by the fact that in San Diego, within the San Diego Police Department, we have 5 dedicated detectives in 1 investigative unit. That's all they do is investigate these elder crimes. So I get quality investigations being brought to me every single day by these detectives.
Do other jurisdictions around the country, to the best of your knowledge, have such dedicated officers and a person in the DA's office to focus on these crimes, or is this unique to San Diego?
It's not unique, but it is sporadic, unfortunately. And what it requires, Richard, is the leader of the prosecutor's office and the chief of the local police to be talking with one another and to understand together that elder abuse crimes are going to be one of the biggest challenges in the criminal justice system in the next 10 years. I'm not being overdramatic.
No, I'm being
realistic. And it's going to take vision. And somebody with absolute passion for protecting the elderly that is going to say, okay, I'm going to dedicate 1, 2, 3 prosecutors in my office to prosecuting these crimes. And slowly but surely, it's happening around the country. It's happening in Philadelphia area, in Bucks County, I know, in other places around Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Gradually, the message is getting through.
If somebody's a victim of elder abuse, especially physical abuse, I know there's a place in New York City in one of the Jewish homes that has a dedicated unit for victims of elder abuse. Do you have places where you can refer people, actually safe homes? They exist for spousal abuse and child abuse, but do they exist in your knowledge out there or around the country a lot?
No. In fact, the one you just referred to in New York is a wonderful example of what it should be like all over the country. And that is one of the biggest problems that we face is where an elder needs to be. What I try to do, though, is keep the elderly victim in the place to which they are most familiar. So if they've been abused in their own home, it's typically by a family member. So hopefully we can arrest that person, get them out of the home, have them on a high bail with a no contact so they don't have the opportunity to go back to that home. But then the problem is we may just have removed the one single caregiver, and I use that term loosely, caregiver,
right.
who has at least been in the home. So the next problem is, how do we fill that void? And that's where I work with our local adult protective services to try to make sure that that victim is being properly cared for and doesn't become a victim again.
We only have a couple of minutes left before we have to end here on the Kendall segment of Boomer Generation Radio. But I guess I have to ask this question. What do you look for? What do you look for? Are there telltale signs? You know, like you said at the beginning of the segment, people may be dealing with some cognitive impairment. They may have fallen and have a bruise that may be perfectly normal. Real quickly, what do we look for to see if this physical abuse, it's hard, I imagine, with financial or other, but what do you look for?
Great question. Number one, isolation. Once neighbors, family members see that the elderly relative is being isolated, which was totally different from what normally happens, particularly where a new person has come into their life, then that is immediately should be responded to with a call to their local adult protective services and or their local police department for a welfare check. If you do see an older adult for the first time in several weeks and their appearance has changed, they've lost weight, they look disheveled, or you see indications of memory impairment, if you're in their home and the phone is constantly ringing, if you see bills unpaid, those are all indicators that something is amiss. And I'm constantly, Richard, I'll wrap up with this. I'm constantly telling Boomer Generation folks, you have got to stay in touch daily with your parents. My mother, 90 years of age, lives 6,000 miles away, but I made a commitment to her 18 months ago. I am going to phone you every single morning before I go to work. And I try to do that without fail because that's the only way I can keep track of her movements and to make sure that nobody has come into her life that shouldn't be there and to make sure that everything is fine.
Paul, thank you very much. We've been speaking with Paul Greenwood from the District Attorney's Office in San Diego County, who's been prosecuting issues and cases of elder abuse. And I want to thank you, Paul, very much for a ton of really great information. And I hope people who listen to this and then listen to the podcast later on really take to heart of what you're saying. And I just want to thank you again and also remind our audience that this portion of Boomer Generation Radio has been brought to you by Kendall, the Kendall Corporation, a system of not-for-profit communities and services that advocates for and empowers older adults to reach their full potential. Together, we are transforming the experience of aging, and to learn more about Kendall, that's K-E-N-D-A-L. We invite you to visit kendall.org or call toll-free at 888-759-0128. That's Kendall, K-E-N-D-A-L, at kendall.org. And the toll-free number again is 888-759-0128. And again, thank you to Paul Greenwood for being our guest here on this segment, the Kendall segment of Boomer Generation Radio. Sadly, no one came up with the correct answer for our Phillies tickets for opening day next Monday from our quiz. So they'll go to a very deserving person, I hope, if you can use them, our producer, Tony. And in the very few seconds we have left, a point of personal privilege on this April 1st. Looking forward to Sunday afternoon, April the 6th, and wishing my son and his fiancée, Debbie, a life of great happiness and joy as they're to be married on Sunday afternoon. And good luck, good health, and much happiness. Tony, thank you. To all of you, thank you again for joining us on Boomer Generation Radio. We'll see you next Tuesday morning here on WWDB AM 860 and live streaming WWDBAM.com. Thank you. Have a great week, everyone.